arriving somewhere along the way. To kick us off, I'd like to first ask individual members of the board and the team here at the Department of Health to introduce themselves. And then we'll also be asking members of the public to also introduce yourselves so we can document your participation in today's meeting. We have a number of items on the agenda today, but I want to remind everyone that there is the opportunity for public comment at the end of this session. So if there are things that you want to bring to the board, something you want to make us aware of, that will be the opportunity to do so. With that, if I could start with team member on my right, Ben.
Hi, Benjamin Miles, board member.
Good morning, Alan Friedman, board member.
Tamara McCants, board member.
Oh, good morning, Shauna White, executive director.
Corinne Barron, health licensing specialist for the D.C. Board of Pharmacy.
Luan Grunoy, program specialist.
Hugh Hong, pharmacy student intern.
Brandon Pease, legal intern.
Good morning, Carla Williams, board counselor.
And with that, we call the board meeting to order. We do have a quorum. We can note that for the minutes. And I'd ask if members of the public, if you would please identify yourselves as well.
Good morning, everybody. I'm Lisa Lindapp with Express Scripts.
Kevin Moore. I'm on the advisory committee for clinical laboratory practitioners.
Welcome.
Tom Zulaner, public.
Jennifer Thomas with Claret.
Andrew Long, pharmacy student.
Jason Brown, pharmacy resident, trusted health plan.
I'm Marissa Sabile, pharmacy resident, trusted health plan. Tupone, Stanford, Kaiser, Feminist. Deidre Payne, Walmart.
Wonderful. Welcome. Yes.
I'm just going to mention the AC is pretty, at least to me, loud back here. So appreciate if everybody can speak up.
Indeed, the acoustics are a bit of a challenge. We shall do our best to project as we're talking. Thank you, Don, for that. So following along, if we could, then board members are directed to the open session agenda as presented. The first item on the agenda is approval of the open session minutes from both April and May of 2019. So I'd ask you to ensure you've reviewed those appropriately and ask if anyone would like to make a motion.
Do we need two separate motions?
Yes, please.
I move to approve the May minutes.
Is there a second for approval of the May minutes? That's a pretty easy one.
Yes, that's why.
Okay. Second by Alan Friedman. Any discussion around approval of the May minutes? Seeing none, is there a consensus around the motion? Going up and down. All right. In that case, all in favor, say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Abstentions?
Abstain.
One abstention. Motion carries. Thank you. Next, the April 4, 2019 minutes. Is there a motion?
Yes, I move that we accept the April minutes as presented.
Motion.
Second? Second.
Motion's been moved and seconded. Is there any dialogue around the April 4, 2019 open session minutes? Seeing none, ready to call the question. Is there consensus around approval of the minutes as presented? Okay. So all those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No. Abstentions? One abstention. All right, with that motion carries, and those minutes are duly approved. We'll now ask our executive director, Dr. White, to provide a licensing report.
Sure. Good morning, everyone, and thank you all for coming to our board meeting today. I'm going to stand up right here so everyone can hear me. Just let me know, speak up a little louder. So our pharmacy statistics for this month, we have 2,026 pharmacists licensed in the District of Columbia. 617 of those pharmacists have vaccination and immunization authority. We 142 pharmacy interns, 851 pharmacy technicians, 125 pharmacy technician trainees. We have 11 pharmacy technician training programs, and we have 799 pharmaceutical detailers. For our prescription drug monitoring program, all licensed pharmacists should have received an email from our office concerning the mandatory prescription drug monitoring registration date. We have been reaching out to everyone about the prescription drug monitoring program. There was information provided on the pharmacist renewal. We also had information in our pharmacy board newsletter that we work on with NADP. That information is on our website. So we're also in the process of sending out a mailer to everyone's home. So if you are not registered, we would encourage you to get registered and also encourage your colleagues to get registered. Right now, we have about 40% of pharmacists registered, which is good. However, right now, the veterinarians have a little over 50%. And their patients are animals. So we can definitely do better. So we will be sending out more communication and bombarding your emails and encouraging everyone to get registered. So please reach out to your colleagues just to ensure that they're registered by the deadline, and that deadline is July the 31st. The Mayor's Opioid Strategic Plan, this will be a standing item on our agenda. That information is on the Live Long DC website. The country is in the midst of an opioid crisis, so we will just be talking about that from now until we have addressed all the issues in the city. So just for awareness, if you want to have any insider information to what the District of Columbia is doing, who our partners are, community partners, what the mayor's priorities are, that information is on the website. I'm going to wait for Dr. Bernard to come in to give some of the NADP updates from the meeting. So we'll give that during the communication section.
Thank you. Any board members, any questions for Dr. Wade?
I do have a question. In reference to the opioid strategic plan, is there anything specifically that pharmacists should be doing or paying attention to?
As far as that anything, one of those is the registration for prescription drug monitoring program. Mm-hmm. That is a part of the strategic plan to ensure that providers are registered for the prescription drug monitoring program.
In terms of the prescription monitoring program registration, is there any penalty for pharmacists who do not comply, or any penalty for the employer of pharmacists who are not in compliance with that new requirement?
Right. So there, at this time, we haven't developed a penalty for any employers, because the employers aren't necessarily registered with us as a healthcare professional. As far as providers, at this time, are letting everyone know they need to register, and it could be some penalty as far as when they renew their license, but we are getting that together now as far as regulations and things like that and policies are concerned. So right now we're just giving everyone a deadline and hoping they comply.
Right. Any other questions for Dr. White? Moving on, your Assistant General Counsel report, a couple of items there.
Yes, good morning. So the first is the drafted CPR policy, training policy statement. So I believe this was presented to the board in April. I was not present for that meeting, but my colleague, Mr. Gozil, brought this in for you. And it was not approved at that time. So I brought it back to understand if there's something that I need to do, or if we are now in a position to approve this. So there are some requirements in the regulations for pharmacists who are certified to administer vaccinations and immunizations, that you must maintain an active certification in cardiopulmonary resuscitation for healthcare providers. Earlier this year, we received a couple of requests to accept online CPR courses. There's some entrepreneurs that have started offering CPR solely online. While that may be helpful to a layperson to be able to help save a family member or a friend's life, as licensed healthcare professionals, you're held to a higher standard. And should you be unable to save a life because you only took CPR online and did not know how to actually hands-on do it, you would probably have some legal liability. So the board is not comfortable with people taking CPR solely online. So that's the policy statement, is just to clarify that. So at this point, this is just brought back for discussion.
Okay. We're going to have discussion. Is there anyone who wants to make a motion that will help enable our discussion by chance?
I want to amend what the statement says. The discussion that I would like to have.
All right.
So right now the statement says the board will not accept a CPR course that is completed online in whole or in part. And I think that we all agree that there are some hybrid programs where there is a didactic portion online, but there is another portion where you go in and you demonstrate your skills, and that we were generally all okay with that, and so we wanted to change the language here slightly.
Okay, so that's the part that didn't get back to me.
Oh.
So you just simply want to say that we're not accepting a CPR course that's completed solely online?
Yes.
Is that everyone comfortable with that?
Yes.
Okay, well, would that change?
How do we distinguish between physical, behavioral elements of CPR versus some of the knowledge points about body positioning, et cetera, that might be done online versus the physical? Is there a way to word that so we can be clear on which parts are not?
We could say something about that there has to be a live demonstration. So, like, they can, participants can review the didactic portion online with the live demonstration of
it's
technique.
Basically, it's called a skills test out.
Yeah. Assessment.
Yeah. With a live skills assessment.
Strengthen this and communicate the intent of the board around that. Now we have a motion on the table. Does anyone want to second it?
Second.
Discussion. Would it be okay, Carlos, just one more time, you could say what that language is? The document that's provided, the agenda, refers first to the the title and the law and everything, and then it ends with, if you're unclear about anything, contact the board. But that bit that's the sort of operational part of the statement, could you just say that one more time just so we have it crystal clear for the members of the board?
Sure. So the third paragraph, you're following along, this policy statement clarifies that the certification in cardiopulmonary resuscitation for healthcare providers requirement, CPR course, must be met through completion of a live course. The board will not accept a CPR course that is completed solely online, period. The CPR course must contain a live skills assessment, period.
All right, thank you. Any additional discussion, board? All right, so general consensus in favor of the motion?
Yes, yes.
Appropriate direction. In that case, I'll ask, there's consensus on the motion, I'll ask for those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed, say no. Any abstentions? The motion carries.
Okay, and for the next part, thank you. I will ask if Mr. Marr can come to this table. Good morning.
Good morning.
So together we'll make this presentation. So I think you said previously it was moving around. If you just want to introduce yourself again and maybe a little bit of your background and your role on the advisory committee.
Okay, I'm Dr. Kevin Moore. I am a my background is I'm board certified clinical laboratory director. I currently work at the Food and Drug Administration, I hold a position on the advisory committee as the supervisory medical technologist member of the committee. To date, I believe we've met 4 times, we've been working on reviewing the clinical laboratory practitioner legislation. We've been working primarily on the licensure requirements and continuing education to date. And in our review, we've identified 7 acceptable qualifying examinations as prerequisites for licensure. We've identified several acceptable CE providers, agreed upon annual CE requirements, the number of credits that were required, and we've identified importantly, several concerns with the legislation, and we're recommending updating the language. Specifically, there was an omission of the provisions that indicated that the position of laboratory director could be held by a board-certified PhD, and the language that's currently written seems to have deleted that portion. So we're recommending that that be placed back in and corrected, as well as there was a section on the exemptions in which there was a fair amount of debate in our meetings about what they meant, so we thought that there should be some clarification provided to the language. And overall, the committee feels that these amendments are needed to the law in order to make the law more consistent with the actual practice of these professions.
Thank you. So I believe everyone's given a copy of the law. Yes. So just to show you, the advisory committee is recommending that we make some changes to the law before we move forward to regulations because these are pretty fundamental. This law started being drafted. They were working on it before I got here. So it's about 15, 16 years ago they started. So I think some things just maybe the professions have changed a little bit from when they started working on this, and then some things seem to have probably just been errors that were made in the drafting. So what the committee is asking and recommending is that the board would vote to have the committee draft legislation to amend the law, and then it would go through the process, and hopefully council would enact it, and then with those changes, we can move forward with the regulations. It is also my recommendation, the committee's recommendation, that we would do this, propose it as an emergency amendment, because we know that these professions do need to get licensed and regulated as soon as possible. So we would want to see if we can get this moving. But we do feel that some of these are kind of fundamental groundwork things that have to be done before the regulations can stand up. So I just wanted to, if we could point to a couple of them. Dr. Mark had me on missing something.
Okay.
But he mentioned the laboratory director. Is that on page?
I'm sorry, I don't have a copy of the break in front of me.
The bill?
Yeah.
The legislation. Making it clear when you would need to waive health professionals who have licenses, such as physicians and nurses, from needing to be licensed or registered in any of these categories. However, I think there's some tests that it's okay for them to do, and then there's some that are considered more complex, and the advisory committee did not feel necessarily those tests would be appropriate. This would be the exemption piece on page 6, section 763, and this is where we had a lot of debate, and I actually went back to the attorney who drafted this bill, and he indicated that what we understood it to be is what was intended. Exemption from licensure for select clinical laboratory practitioners. The licensure section, which is in section 1001, shall not apply to, and I will not try to name those physicians, who is licensed or registered in the district under any other act, or who engages in the practice for which he or she is licensed or registered. It's kind of vague, but basically we took it to mean that if you're licensed as a physician or a nurse, you can work in the laboratories and perform under these different types of professions without needing a specific license. And it may be appropriate for some tests, but not others. Is that about right, Dr. Mark? So I think we want to kind of clarify that, because this seems to be a kind of blanket waiver, and we're not sure that that's appropriate.
So what we're seeing here is current
law.
Okay, and we're talking about amending the recommendation to amend that.
Yes, clarifying that so it's a little clearer what it means, but then also saying that so right now it kind of just says everything.
Right.
And the committee doesn't think that necessarily everything should be waived.
Okay.
Some tests would be appropriate, some would not.
Okay.
So that would be one of the areas we want to change.
Are you recommending specific language for that change, or we haven't got there yet?
No, we're asking, the charge of the committee was to help to develop regulations.
Right.
But the committee actually thinks that there's some problems with the law.
Law.
Oh, okay.
So we're now asking the board to vote for the committee to draft amendments to the law.
Got it. Okay.
And then we would
come back to you
to vote to move it.
Okay.
So the ultimate motion that we'll put forward then essentially say that we ask the committee to work with appropriate staff to modify these areas of the law. We're not going to propose language. We're just going to say these are issues that need to be identified.
Right. To propose legislation to amend the law. And we want you to know, because you're basically expanding their scope a bit here, and then what areas we're looking at, although you're not limiting us to that if they discover something. The second one is on page 7, and that was the laboratory director piece Dr. Mara referred to. It says a physician or a dentist, and I think it's pretty common in labs that PhD professionals are lab directors. And so if you look at the types of certifications that make you eligible, it indicates that it would be someone at a PhD level. Is that correct, Dr. Mark?
Right. Under one subsection, certification by the American Board of Medical Microbiology, American Board of Clinical Chemistry, American Board of Bioanalysis, and other national accrediting boards in at least one of the laboratory specialties. These are specifically intended for PhDs. So there was a portion that directed us towards the PhD qualification, but it was sort of omitted in the description. So that should just be omitted.
Right. But if we don't fix that, then there's a whole lot of people who are currently lab directors that would not be able to be a lab director because they're neither a physician or a dentist. So that's one of the fundamental ones. I think those were the two biggest, and there may have been some more minor tweaks as well.
Right. Right.
But if the board is comfortable with expanding the scope of the advisory committee to work on legislation, then I do have a wonderful intern sitting at the end of the table, and we will have a draft ready for you to look at our August meeting. So we just need a vote to authorize the advisory committee to work on legislation to amend the actual law as needed to be consistent with the current practice of clinical practitioners. That's correct.
So moved. I'm writing it out.
Second. Discussion. As a case example, you mentioned a bit about where it says a physician or dentist who's qualified, etc. Would you imagine, not holding you to it, but the language would simply be changed to an individual who's qualified instead of trying to list out all the different disciplines that that person might come from and what level of credential they may have, et cetera. If they have one of these other certifications, would it just be individual, or are you thinking of
I think PhD? It's important to specify the training and education that an individual has in order to direct. There's a federal requirement that spells these out, and we intend to meet or exceed that for DC. So being specific, I think, is probably better.
So you're saying you would imagine, say, a physician, dentist, nurse, PhD, biochemist, you intend to try to list every possible discipline versus relying on the certification that's underlying in all the items.
Right, because these certifications don't necessarily apply to a dentist, right? They would have their own series of requirements. So these, the ones that were listed here, were specific for the PhD.
Is that a very long list, the federal one?
No, not necessarily.
Any questions around any of this from members of the board? Could someone reiterate the motion that has been moved and seconded, more or less?
The motion is for the Board of Pharmacy to authorize the Clinical Practitioner Advisory Committee to draft legislation amending Laboratory Practitioners Amendment Act of 2014 to make it more consistent with current laboratory practice.
Yes, Clinical Practitioners
Laboratory Amendment Act of 2014.
I thought that's what I heard the first time. I just
wanted to get back to
it. All right. Any further discussion or questions? All right, is the consensus around the motion?
Yes.
Affirmative, all right, then I'll call the question and ask for a vote of the board. All those in favor of the motion, signify by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, no. Abstentions? Motion carries. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. Moore.
Thank you,
Dr. Moore.
Would you like
this back? You can keep that. Thank you.
All right.
See you at the
have
next
meeting.
Have a great day.
And thank you for taking this on.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
And that concludes my report.
Next, we'll move to a report from the Legislative and Regulatory Subcommittee. And Alan, are we going to lead that report, starting with the Providing Access to Women's Healthcare Services Amendment Act of 2017?
I am. So just a brief update. We are waiting for the Board of Medicine to provide the subcommittee made up of members of the Board of Pharmacy and Board of Medicine with a draft of the algorithm. So currently, Board of Pharmacy has already put together a draft of the patient self-assessment and also a referral form for the committee's review. And this really is sort of almost the last piece. There's some additional educational materials, but that will sort of come after everything else is approved. And so once the Board of Medicine shares with the committee that draft algorithm, the committee will reconvene, approve that, and it'll go before the Board of Medicine and the Board of Pharmacy, respectively, all the committee recommendations for approval, and be able to then move the whole process forward. Okay? So that's what we're waiting for.
Is there any help that any member of the board or staff could provide to help get on to the next stage of the project?
So when the subcommittee met, we agreed to divvy up responsibilities. We've completed our part. They very kindly volunteered to head up this piece. It's been a while, to be honest, and I got word this morning, actually, that they do have a draft. We just haven't seen it yet. So, Shauna has been certainly in contact with her colleague, the executive director for Board of Medicine, and knows that we're anxiously awaiting. So, I think that's where we are.
I note that in the bill, the first five or six words are to declare. declare the existence of an emergency. February 2018, right?
Well, clearly our colleagues in the Board of Medicine haven't seen it as an emergency.
It says right at the top of the thank you for continuing to work that through. There are a lot of challenges, but certainly doing it jointly at multiple boards is a much more powerful way. It just may take a little more time.
What I may do is, if it's okay with the board, just maybe send an email to the exec director and to the physician who's working on this to ask for a deliverable due date, and that way we can at least lock them in to a commitment. I think at this point, it's been since February, that is more than reasonable.
Maybe Sean has sent that email?
Well, I feel like, honestly, at this point, if it were to come to the whole committee and not just sort of work on the back end, because there's communications happening in the background, but the whole committee, I think, needs to be very, that's what I'm looking for. The committee should be overtly aware that this is what we're waiting for, and everybody should be holding that individual accountable. And I think it coming from a committee member, actually, at this point, might carry more weight, because Sean has been working behind the scenes.
Okay.
Right? I think just putting it out there and let everybody see it in writing sort of forces the hand and says, you have to respond back in writing, give us a due date, whatever it is, we'll work with it, but just commit. We had a commitment that we had to meet on the Board of Pharmacy side, and we met it that day. So, it works both ways.
Well, certainly with Shauna working through her contact there, and with you working colleague to colleague, sounds like it would be the next logical step.
And I think it would be appropriate, Tamara, because the physician had reached out to me for materials, and Shauna responded back. So I think I have an avenue to respond.
Okay. Thank you. Any questions, anything from board on that item? So moving on then to collaborative practice.
So I need to recuse myself for this section, so I'll step out.
Thank you. The minutes show that Dr. Miles has
absent himself.
So the conversation really hasn't come out of the entirety of the legislative and regulatory subcommittee. I think my understanding is that there's been conversation about the current regulation related to collaborative practice in the District of Columbia, and an ask from specifically the institution community that we go back and take a look at the training requirements, that what we have in place may be prohibitive for pharmacists to participate in collaborative practice. And I think, you know, from the board's perspective, we might look at the landscape in its entirety, not just for institution, but I think, it's been a while, but I believe there's a section for institutions specifically with a lot of requirements. Many of those marry the section that's not related to institution. So if we're going to change one, would we change the other? There are some pieces that are specific to institutions, but I believe the training requirements are the same in both sections. We can confirm. So they are the same in both sections. So that's the recommendation, and we can certainly take a look at it. It's really coming down to as simple as an and or an or, but apparently those two simple words on the surface are causing some complication, because the and means you have to do all of these things, and the or means you could do this or you could do that. And by considering the or, it might broaden the possibilities for people to participate who perhaps have the appropriate training already without having to go through all of the checkboxes. So that's the background, as I understand it. Tamara, is that your understanding as well?
definitely.
Okay.
So is there a motion that will operationalize our intent?
So I think yes, there would be a motion that we can make if the board wants to support a change. The way it would work is that we'd make a motion. If the board decides they want to change the regulation, it would then be published in the DC Register. It would go through a formal comment period. We would take into consideration those comments, and the board would then decide to either further amend or to approve or not approve, and depending on how much they want to amend, it could be republished again, or it could just be published as final with that change, or not.
Okay. I just wanted to make sure that this need to go through the Board of Medicine as well?
Yeah, it would need to go, because the original legislation required that the two agencies work collaboratively on this, and so if we're going to amend it, it would have to go to the Board of Medicine for their input as well before it's published.
Can we just state what exactly would be changing on the track?
Yeah, so
I need to do that.
Please.
Yeah. So in your documents, it's section 10001.7, to be eligible to participate in the collaborative practice agreement, a pharmacist shall, and this is the same thing that's listed in the institutional section as well. A would remain the same, possess relevant advanced training as indicated by the following. The question is, with B, there's currently a requirement of an and. So instead of saying you have to have both A and B, we'd now be saying you have to have A or B. So you either have to have the certification or successful completion of the programs identified, or successfully completed the minimum of 3 or 5 years.
Is the advanced training or the 3 to 5 years?
I'm sorry, what did
you say? Oh, I just wanted to clarify that we wanted to change it to be A or B.
Correct.
Which is the relevant training or the years of experience.
Correct.
Okay, so after a certificate program approved by the Board of Pharmacy, the proposal is to change that word and to or?
Yes.
Would you want to?
Right.
Yes.
Let's record show that we've asked Dr. Miles to participate in this discussion because this is a separate item from an additional agenda item. This has to do with changing the legislation, and I'm glad to practice, and Dr. Miles has considerable experience with that, separate from the request coming in from Sibley, his home institution. So there are two different discussions, two different items to talk about. So we've
done a lot. Okay. So I've shared with the board what I think is the request.
Okay.
Right? And it's not necessarily coming from the whole committee, but it's sort of subcommittee. This forward for consideration, right?
Yes.
And so what I did was I just for discussion, I pulled up Maryland because thinking back through our conversation when we first passed this, Carla had pointed out that, you know, we went through a number of versions and we may have had the training in two different places and we sort of married them all together. Can you hear?
It's a little small.
Oh. Yeah, it's...
Mm-hmm. From back
yeah,
here.
Yeah, it's like that on the Comar site, too. Anyway, we went through a number of versions before we eventually passed the regulation. And at one point, we had some of the training in different places, but we put it all together. And so I just went back to Maryland because I think that at the time, we were looking at Maryland as well and sort of aligning. Now, I'm not suggesting that just because Maryland's doing it that way that we should. We don't have to lead. We can follow. There's no right or wrong about that. But just for conversation, I wanted to look at what a neighboring jurisdiction was doing and how that may or may not align with what we're doing. So as I read Maryland... I think for our purposes, the conversation really begins here. also shall possess relevant advanced training as indicated by here's your certification piece. And it says, or successful completion of the residency certificate program, national cessation, credentialing. And then it goes on, and there's no and or here. It just goes, but it's further down, right?
One, two, three, four, five.
And then it says, shall have 1,000 hours of clinical experience or 320 hours of instructor experience program by the board, and shall document. And so it would all be, you have to have all of them, not four. So I'm just pointing that out just for conversation. And I think, again, we probably based some of ours, but we went through a lot of iterations before we landed where we did. So it's not exactly the same as this. The point is they're looking for some of both the certification or the residency coupled with completed of clinical experience.
It's pretty consistent with our current.
Exactly. It is It is consistent with ours. And again, that doesn't make it right or wrong. It's just what it is. I think their experience is a little different because they say 1,000 hours or 320 hours in a structured experience program. That probably is not exactly the same as 3 or 5 years for PharmD, non-PharmD.
That to me looks more like the...
More the related training part
of ours, but I'm not seeing here that they're even accounting for experience. So basically they're saying that you can't participate in a collaborative practice agreement unless you have some type of formal training, right?
And a doctor of pharmacy. Yes, you're right. So,
right.
Well, it says... Or it says shall possess a doctor of pharmacy or equivalent training as in B. Yeah. Oh, yeah, so I didn't mention this. So B down here, if you don't have the doctor of pharmacy, you can have training that includes the following components, and they list seven different things that are specific to drug, they call it drug therapy management, Maryland, same as collaborative practice here. So you can have doctor of pharmacy, or if you just have a RPH, you just have to have this specific training.
Right. But you still have to have one of those other things.
You still have to have all the other stuff.
Right. And so just to be clear for the audience, the premise is that our original intent was to account for the years of experience, not just a residency training or a certificate. So that's why we want to change it. I think I'll speak for the fact that I still want to move forward with the amended change that we're considering, so that we can account for years of experience.
One of the things that I wanted to mention is that we have this, it requires residency training or board certification plus 3 more years of experience. And when somebody is undergoing residency training, they get, and especially in a hospital setting, they get a lot of training in many of the areas that are covered by collaborative practice. And it doesn't make a lot of sense to me that somebody could go through a year of residency training, finish their residency, and then still not be able to do the things that they just spent a year training to do. And so that was one of the reasons why I wanted to propose the change. And then the other thing is that in order to sit for a board examination by the Board of Pharmacy Specialties, they consider a residency equivalent to 3 years of experience. They allow you to sit for the examination upon completion of a residency or upon completion of 3 years of experience with documented clinical time. So I wanted to be a little more in line with that.
So thinking about the entirety of the landscape of pharmacy practice, what's the thought around community practice, whether it be independent or retail or managed care, because there's community practice residencies, there's managed care, you know, AMCP managed care residencies, ASHP community residencies, AmCare residencies, etc. Do we feel that the educational requirement, the competencies, and preparedness to oversee a collaborative practice clinic would still be satisfied by virtue of doing that residency as well as the institution residency?
Yes.
Yeah.
Because all residencies, especially if it's an accredited residency, but even if it's not accredited, I would say community practice residencies and managed care residencies, if it's stated a PGY-1, notes that there is a minimum of 66% training in direct patient care. So that's the makeup of those residency programs that's noted as a PGY-1. The only exemption is the, you know, association management residency program. So, yes, I do believe that training for those residency programs would qualify for a person to be able to do this direct patient care.
So, having worked now with residents for a few years, I concur that the skill set can prepare them to participate in a collaborative practice clinic and engage in a protocol. I guess if you could just help me understand, by adding the OR, we're then not requiring the certification or any special training relative to that clinic. So if somebody did any coag clinic versus a diabetes clinic, would they still be required to do some sort of specialized training? Or by making this change, if a pharmacist says, I'm a PharmD and I've worked for 3 years, or I'm a non-PharmD and I've worked for 5 years, or I'm a resident and I've now got 1 year because we're going to take out the and, they can automatically participate?
No, because C says that we still have the and C shall have documented training related to the area of practice covered by the collaborative practice agreement.
Okay.
So, and I actually like that language because it doesn't say that it has to be a certificate program. It could be an in-house program. It's really up to us as a board to determine if that training is sufficient. And I also want us to remember that it's still a collaborative practice agreement with the physician. So the physician still has to feel comfortable with whatever pharmacist they're going to be working with. So there's still an onus on the physician to ensure that the pharmacist that they are delegating this responsibility to, you know, that they feel confident that the pharmacist can do the duties and responsibilities. But that answers your question.
Yeah, so they still have to have the training specific to that protocol.
Yeah.
Okay. And I'm assuming, I'm just looking, Carla, at 10,009, but I'm assuming in the other section it would say she'll have documented training related to their covered by the facility practice protocol, just not institution. Just Carla, a question about technicality with making the change. If the board were to approve that change, and assuming medicine did as well, it was published, is the public comment period then only open to that change, or could the public comment on any other change that they might want to see the board consider at that time related to the rest?
They can only comment on the proposal.
Okay.
Are we prepared to recommend sort of one modest tweak, or is this discussion suggesting there's more we want to do? Does it, we have to go back and ask the subcommittee to propose something more specific that we talked about in August?
Well, that's the only reason I'm asking, not to belabor this, but because this has recently come up, when we worked for a while on the RICS, and we got it to a place that we felt comfortable. If you remember the Board of Medicine, there were like five areas that the Board of Medicine came back and said we don't agree with the Board of Pharmacy's position on, and they wanted us to change the language in those five areas, and we essentially concurred on all five areas because we wanted to just get this done and get some experience. And then we had always said that later on down the line, if we want, because members of the public wanted us to consider different things too to change, that we might revisit. Is this an opportunity to do that? Do we want to look at any of the other pieces, or do we not want to go down that path?
I mean, I think you make a good point.
It's been a while.
And it kind of almost goes back to, going back to the Sibley discussion. Like, okay, well, what is going to be like the go-between to kind of help facilities be able to function while we're figuring it out? So I actually think that's a good point. To refer to Greg back to the committee for us to look at everything, because I don't want us to every time, you know, I want us to thoroughly look at it. We look at it and then put it out one time, so it's really just one revision for us to not have to do another revision, you know, every time we kind of look, you know, something comes up. So I think that's really a good point. So do you need a motion for that? Okay. So I move that we take the collaborative practice regulations and refer it back to the legislative and regulations subcommittee for review.
There's a motion on the floor. Is there a second for the motion?
I'll second.
Discussion.
So
I just
wanted to know. No, but okay, so we could commit, it's us. So we just work, we can meet quickly, we can work it through, let's get this done, let's don't hold it up. The Board of Medicine, I mean, I think we're gonna be mindful of as we go into this, the more changes we make, the more changes we have to work with them on. So we should be careful to make sure that we're looking at what we think is really critical here. And then put that out. And at the end of the day, if we think that there are no other changes to recommend,
we just don't make them.
Yeah, but at least we look at it. So to tomorrow's point, we don't have another request, because it'll be hard to work with the Board of Medicine for all those carve outs too.
Yeah,
trying to just get us to a better place in the long run.
Sure.
Okay.
Is there a? And it's just changes to regulation.
Just regulation. I suggest not to the.
Right, any other discussion? So the motion on the floor that's been seconded is to have the Legislative Regulatory Subcommittee review the collaborative practice regulations and make recommendations. The chair of the subcommittee's indicated he wants to do this on a timely basis.
Tomorrow.
I was going for August. All right. Any final? Discussion. If not, is there a consensus around the motion?
Yeah.
All right, in that case, I'll ask all those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Motion carries. All right, so that was a broader issue, but now if we're going to go in and talk about the next item under collaborative practice, Dr. Miles is now departing the room. Thank you, Dr. Miles, for your contributions to the last discussion. All right. Now, we have a request from Sibley Hospital that relates to some of their institutional-based certificate programs regarding training for various collaborative practice activities, warfarin management, parenteral nutrition management, vancomycin injection management, and immunoglobulin injection. This was the request was sent in to Shauna. is this something, who wants to speak to? Is this something that we would ask Mr. Friedman to do, or would Shauna speak to?
Okay, so sent in their training programs for these disease states for collaborative practice. So as you know, in an institutional setting, warfarin management and TPN, and vancomycin dosing and aminoglycoside dosing is typically done in a hospital pharmacy. Simply wanted the Board of Pharmacy to look at their training program and to approve their training program so that pharmacists who hadn't been practicing through a residency program, but have been doing this for years, can complete the training program and document that they have training. So our regulation, I think we went through that earlier, and I can pull that up on the agenda as far as collaborative practice for institutional settings in 10009 to speak to.
Members, in your materials, you have not only the letter requesting approval, but a very comprehensive set of materials as it relates to the training programs that are requesting approval.
I'm going to put up. I move that we approve the training materials provided by Sibley Hospital.
I'll second.
So I made the motion so that we can have this for discussion, and I am generally in favor of reviewing of approving these materials, but I would like for us to formalize the process similar to what we do for the more extensive programs, like what we do for like the CE programs, for the detailers and pharmacy technician training programs. But I don't want to hold this up, but I think we need to just have like a more objective process with a checkoff sheet, etc.
So with the check, I'm sorry, go ahead.
I almost feel like I'm talking myself out of not approving it right now. You know, I just want us to have a more formal process.
So when you say a more formal process, would that, do you envision like training programs that one is going to send to the board for approval needs to contain?
Right, so we'll have
check, and then we just look to see, is this element here, is this element
that's
here?
Right, so come up with the criteria, especially because the language and the law is so broad.
Right, so I was looking through the material, looking for like, okay, do you have a test? Have you identified?
I'm sorry, I need to withdraw.
Well, this is part of the discussion.
Oh, okay, we need to have a more formal process, and I don't, you know, then we can bring Brent back to discuss the formal process, but like what the components really need to be, or maybe that's something that's referred back to the subcommittee as well. But I think we need to have a more formal process.
Well, I would just offer that we certainly have it, Marty.
You've
certainly participated in the development of some of the protocols that we have for review of other materials outside. I think it's a very good point we got to have that. Since we're just talking about things, do you have some idea, since you have some of that experience to draw upon, some templates, perhaps models, is this the sort of thing it would take a month to develop the process, or
no,
6 months or something, any sense of that?
No, definitely not. Yeah, we, I can actually put together the components of the what the checklist should look like with the input of the board, I think we could, I would like for us to spend some time maybe in closed session to discuss it today, and then we can put it together today, honestly. You know, just coming to a consensus as to what some of the things that we want to look for. So, for example, for me, if I'm looking at the presentation and this is a training, I want to see that there's the more recent publications or references. Like, I want to make sure that the training has the most up-to-date information, if that makes sense. So more than just even, and I don't necessarily feel like there needs to be an exam or an assessment associated with the training. For me, what's most important is that they have the most up-to-date information.
It seems to me, since our role is to protect what's best for citizens, all patients, and civil memorial hospital, that it makes very good sense to have this process put in place. At the same time, I get the sense are anxious to make sure we can enable civil memorial hospital and others to move forward with already well-established programs that can help provide better service to patients. Mm-hmm. Is it plausible that we could entertain a motion around the board establishing this process, and then a separate motion indicating that upon these programs being deemed acceptable under that established process, they would be deemed approved? I'm asking the board their reaction to that. Could we do two separate motions so that as soon as the program is developed, they could be appropriately reviewed and therefore not delayed any longer than is necessary?
Yeah, I'm okay with that. So basically, pending a form, like basically giving an informal approval pending formal review, and then if anything comes back based on a formal review, we can send it back.
I think we would have a motion approving that the board agrees will establish a process to be decided by the board. And then the other motion would be should these training programs be deemed acceptable under that, they could be so approved. Right? I don't think we could be provisional until we actually have a process set up.
So, we already have a submission from Sibley, so we could certainly be looking over between now and then anyway. It seems like you could do both at the same time. If the list is presented to the board and they approve it, at the same meeting you could still approve the Sibley, or you could say to Sibley, you're missing X, Y, and Z, and can you submit that? I don't know how you can retroactively go back. I don't see how it benefits them, what we're talking about. I don't think it's going to necessarily help them. I think what I'm hearing Dr. McCants say is that we want a consistent process and we're treating everybody fairly and equally, and also to assure that these programs we're approving do have the elements that are important. So, you know, on the surface it may, but there may be some key things that are missing. And so if we want to do it the right way, I mean, it's been however long since this regulation's been in place. If we were to wait until our next opportunity between now and then, get our ducks in a row and have something presented to approve, we could do it. I'm fine with that. I don't want to... My only concern, honestly, is holding up Sibley. I don't know how... urgent this is. Like, are they being stopped from doing something they need to do all of a sudden? Because again, the regs have been in place for quite some time. So, I'm in favor of taking a moment and just making sure we're doing it the right way.
Agreed. So let's break it down. With the motion that's on the floor right now, should we take action on that, or would you like to draw it?
I'm thinking.
Yes, sure.
I have a couple of questions. So you've had an opportunity to look at what Sibley is presenting.
Mm-hmm.
If we create a checklist, are there things that you anticipate would be on the checklist that are not in the package
that's,
review.
That's exactly what I'm trying to determine right now. I mean, at rough glance, I'm not seeing anything that is not, you know, that... Well, yes, I am. Like, the training materials that's being presented doesn't have, like, a reference page. So I don't know what sources were used to create the training materials, and that's my concern.
So what I'm hearing is it sounds like step one would be to create the checklist. Step two, we would then compare Sibley's materials to that checklist. If there are things that are missing, then they'd need to supply them. And then if all of that is fine, then the board could approve it. So you might not be able to approve it today. You might want to delegate to your executive director that after we receive whatever, you have your checklist, if something's missing, she collects that information from Sibley, and then depending on the timing of it, whether or not it needs to come back to the board, or if you are comfortable with allowing her to say this now meets the requirements in the checklist and to go ahead with approving it so that it doesn't necessarily get held until August or whenever. I think this, I'm not sure this has to be done in an open session. This possibly could be done in our next meeting.
Well, next meeting is August.
We're not meeting in July. So, could do something like that. I don't know if you want to approve them today when you don't have all the information that you anticipate.
Actually, if we can table it to later on, because I'm thoroughly looking at it and I did see the references. So, if I don't know if everybody else has looked at it, but based on what I don't want to be rushed.
Speaking for myself, I've been traveling, so the agenda came to me when I was away, and I just haven't even seen it.
So can we want to withdraw the motion then, or should we?
Yeah, I'm going to withdraw the motion. Yeah.
So I think we'd entertain a motion though that talks about our desire to establish an approval process for the technical.
Sure. And then if I understand correctly, and not to put more on your documents, you typically review these for the other professions.
Mm-hmm.
So then I would recommend two motions. One, to create a checklist, and two, to allow Dr. McCants to review the package once you have the checklist, and then give the approval as she does for the other training programs that you refer. And then that way, so if he does not get held up, but that if it is approved, it's approved with having been properly vetted and us being comfortable that it actually meets your requirements. So.
I'm fine with that. Okay. I move that we establish a formal checklist to review the... I want to get the proper language. Okay, I want to make a motion that we create a formal checklist to review documented training as it relates to collaborative practice agreement.
Motion's been made.
Second.
Any additional discussion around that?
No.
It's a wonderful process. Is there consensus around the motion?
Yeah. I'm sorry. I want the motion is to create a checklist / review process for approving documented training related to the area of practice covered by a collaborative practice agreement.
Debate and second. Is there consensus around the motion? Yes. All those in favor of the motion say aye.
Aye.
And if opposed, say no. Abstentions? Motion carries.
Can you make the motion, Mr.?
Yeah, so I'm going to move that we delegate to Dr. McCants review and approval of the Sibley Hospital materials regarding certification of collaborative practice training.
So we add approval authority.
Yes.
Thank you.
And I don't think we have to call out any particular institution that will say those types of materials.
Do you want this as an ongoing responsibility or just for this one?
I'll take it as an ongoing responsibility.
Okay.
All right, so delegate to Dr. McCants
review
give you an approval authority. For certification materials to meet regulatory requirements regarding the training of lab requirements.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Dr. McCann, second?
Yes, I second.
Wonderful motion. And is there any discussion around that? All right, so is there a consensus around the motion? There is? All right. In that case, I ask all those in favor, please signify by saying aye.
Aye.
And opposed, say no. And any abstentions? The motion carries. Thank you. So we thank you. It was a very valuable discussion, and I think we are moving things forward in a manner that helps protect the D.C. public. I will note that Dr. Bernard has arrived, and I will hand off chairmanship for this meeting to her, and at the same time ask Carla, I think there's an item on your plan of practice. You want to talk about public health?
Yes. Legislative.
Sorry, that's
something. So, I believe when Mr. Gohill was here, he mentioned something about this to you, so we're following up on that, what the Department of Health is doing.
Right. So, as Mr. Gohill mentioned in the last meeting about the public health priorities for the continuing education requirement for all healthcare professions. So, all healthcare professions will be required to choose from a list of continuing education requirement, and that being 10%, with 10% for CEs for pharmacists, will be 4 hours. So instead of the current requirements that we do have for patient safety and HIV, you will be required to take 4 hours from this public health priority list of continuing education. The department will develop the list.
I'm sorry.
Can you say that again?
Right. So, currently right now, for continuing education,
right. We
have the requirements for HIV and patient safety.
Right, med safety.
Right.
And LGBTQ.
Right. But the LGBTQ requirement is still going to be a requirement.
But isn't it up to the board to decide if they still want to keep the med errors and the HIV in addition to?
Right.
Okay.
Yeah. So it's up to the board to decide if they want to keep the med errors and HIV as a requirement or use the public health priority list for continuing education.
For the required. So
right.
I just want to make sure that I understand. So pretty much, instead of saying med errors and HIV, we can have the licensee pick anything from that list for it to make the 4 hours, or does the board have to pick X amount of topics from the list?
So a lot of this will be vetted by the board. What will be required is the 4 hours in the public health priorities.
Okay.
It's up to the board if, in addition to those, you still want to require. But you would not have the option of saying we're going to keep patient safety and HIV and not do the health priorities. So you're not going to have more than 40. It's still going to be 40. But within that 40, there will definitely be 4 hours related to health priorities. And then the others are up to the board if you still want to keep HIV patient med error safety.
And health priorities, is that a topic where there's a lot of different subtopics under health priorities?
Right. So the director in the Department of Health will determine those subjects at least every 5 years, or perhaps less frequently. That information will be disseminated, and then the licensees can choose
whichever ones they want of this.
And which would be most relevant to your practice.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason why we are talking about this now is because although they have not been necessarily completely vetted as far as what they will be, we are moving the regs forward. So the regulations will state, and it's up to the board, I think, to determine when this will become effective. I'm assuming your next renewal period, since you just renewed, that beginning with that renewal period, at least 10% of the total required continuing education, so for a pharmacist, 4, shall be a subject determined by the director as public health priorities of the district every 5 years or less frequently, as deemed appropriate by the director, with notice of the subject matter published in the DC Register, and it shall also be disseminated to the licensee via electronic communication and through publication on our website. So all of the boards are moving forward that more general language in the regulations, and then once that public health priorities list has been set, then the boards will follow up with getting that information out to the licensees.
So, not to get too much into the weeds, but I think it's important that we consider the downstream impact of this. And you may, the answer may not be known yet, but okay, so there's a 5 year or less. So thinking about Virginia, so for example, 1 year the board decided because of the public health crisis, well, the state health crisis in the Commonwealth about opioids a few years ago, they had, for 1 year, they required all pharmacists to do opioid C, and then it went away. But there was notice given before that year. From a timing perspective, we're in a two-year renewal. We wouldn't want to see notice come out 6 months before the end of that renewal. You know, there are pharmacists that plan their year of CE. I'm going to go to certain conferences. I got to get this CE. I got to get that CE. And we wouldn't want to dump. You have to get 4 hours. You get to pick and choose. But now you have 3 months to do it. So, and everybody may be on different cycles. It's all health professions. Just kind of thinking that through to make sure we don't set something up that makes it unreasonable for pharmacists and technicians. It would be technicians too, right?
Yes, and detailers.
And detailers. So just thinking about that, we don't know what the topics are going to be. So I'm assuming there's going to be a variety of topics that could impact all professions, nursing, physicians, pharmacists. And just for the board to be thinking, like if we still have HIV and MedEra, some of the topics may be MedEra HIV coming out from the profession as well. So it could potentially satisfy both or not. So again, I don't know that we can control all of that, but I think we need to be mindful of that as we discuss and make decisions.
Are we clear, Council, that the Board of Pharmacy will get to decide whether or not this mandate takes effect with our next renewal cycle, which would be start March 1, 2021, or does it have to happen sooner? Or are we able to determine it will happen March 1st, 2021?
I believe it's definitely going to be consistent with a renewal. So whether it's 2021 or 2023, I could not say for certain. I would imagine it should be sooner. Now, if you were renewing next year, then obviously that would not make sense for the reasons Mr. Friedman stated. But because it's not till 2021, it's more doable.
Well, make sure my question is clear, that, or my intent, that I do not believe that we could change the regulations for the current period that's underway. So this change would take effect for the reporting period that would start March 1, 2021, and then go out to February 28, 2023. Are we able to say that's the case, or are we going to be forced into requiring people right now before they renew in 18 months to do their thing? Do we get to control that or not? Based on the legislation?
I'll find out, but I do think we can start with the next renewal cycle.
That's important.
So I just want to be clear. So that means with the renewal period, when you get your license 2021, you have to start choosing from this list. After March 1st.
As opposed to this current 2 year cycle
that we're in. That we're already in.
I really think that's wishful thinking, just to be real. I think that's wishful thinking. I think we need to be. Is the list produced?
Right. No, the list is not produced, so that's my concern, too, if the list is not produced.
When do they anticipate that the list is going to be produced? I'm asking too many questions. Okay.
No, we don't know. They're valid questions.
And just to piggyback off that, I think a question that I kind of heard, but and maybe I missed the answer, if there is a decision, if we do see HIV and med errors on the list, what position does that put the board? Can we then come to the table and say, okay, that, since we already have those, we really aren't making any changes. We're not going to say those meet the requirement, or I'm thinking it would be as simple as that.
Well, we want to eliminate that from our regs.
And now have it fall
make,
under this.
Make it a little clearer.
Would med error be a public health thing?
I would think so.
It's going to be
more disease
by the Department of Health.
Right. So it might not necessarily be med error. It might be more so patient safety or something, you know.
What are we being asked to do right now? Because it's difficult for us to be able to say this. So, I mean, if we have to make a decision, I honestly would go with the licensee. We have the option to pick from a list
until
we know what the list looks like.
Yeah, so, okay, so I'm just forward thinking now. Audits. So here we go through CPE monitor. We have the audits. We have the designations that are specific to HIV. Hopefully LGBTQ soon, even though I know that's different legislation. Medication/patient safety. How do we track that somebody did opioid addiction? I mean, the audit, we were finally getting to a place where it was a little bit easier for us to review and be fair to pharmacists and technicians and the representatives. How are we going to possibly manage that?
Great questions. All these are great questions. I have a funny feeling we're not the only board having this exact discussion about this. The intent from a public health perspective makes perfect sense. But when you start to then have the downstream implications thereof, how do we sort through that?
Logistically, it will definitely complicate the process.
So to answer the question of what's being asked of you today, I think the questions I would need to know for us to draft this is, do you want to, whenever this requirement is implemented, to just require the licensees to do their four CEs and the public health initiatives and no longer require HIV and no longer require the med errors in addition to that? They'd still be within the 40, but that would be one question. And then your perfect world, I understand you probably want this to start with 2023 as opposed to 2021. That may or may not be up to us, but if that's your request, that's certainly what we would at least propose as we move forward.
Yeah.
So those would be the two questions that I would need to know. And then Brandon has already started the draft, because right now the language is very general. It's just the blanket boilerplate language that this is coming down the pipeline, it will be 10%, and the public health initiatives will be determined, and then you will be notified. So that's all that's going to be added to the regulations now. The rest will be spelled out more in detail once we have that information.
So I would move that the board's preference would be that this new mandate would be implemented effective with renewals starting in 2023, therefore the CE period starting March 1, 2021, and that consistent with that timing, we would eliminate the separate CE requirement for HIV education, which is 2 hours, and for patient safety, which is also 2 hours. That would be. That's what I would propose our preferences.
That's a motion, right?
Yeah, just to get conversation.
All right, so there's a motion that's been made. Is there a second?
Second.
Discussion. I think that's a great motion. The thing that I would be a little concerned about is we don't know what's going to be on that list, number one. And if I think we have to ask ourselves a question. How much of an issue, how important is it for pharmacists in D.C. to continuously update themselves on HIV therapy and patient safety? Because if it turns out somehow that those two things aren't on the list and then we take them away as a requirement, what that suggests is, okay, you know, that may not be as much of an issue anymore in the district. So I just want us to be comfortable, you know, looking at it from that viewpoint, because again, we don't know what's going to be on this list.
So I'm wondering if there would the department be open to, again, I may not know the answer, but would the department be open to the respective boards providing some recommendations periodically about what might be included, number one, maybe yes, maybe no. Number two, keep in mind that through rulemaking, the board could always add CE. So if we got that list and we saw for the next 5-year period, HIV or med safety wasn't on there, assuming there was enough notice before renewal period started, the 2-year renewal period, you could do that. I'm not suggesting that we're constantly changing. I like just being consistent, everybody knowing well in advance. I would imagine that certain things like opioid and HIV would be there and patient safety, you're right, we don't know. We don't know. What's your thought, Mr. Appleby, about why you want to take out those two components?
Well, my sense is we are now at least as I understand the intent of this from the Department of Health, that they would be indicating to professionals that you choose based on your area of practice what your needs are. I applaud that. That's helpful. My concern is continuing to ratchet down. We're getting to a point where we're telling people, here's your curriculum. And if people, depending on where they practice, they deal a lot with patients with diabetes, we want them to be doing their CE there to keep up with it, right? My instinct is that the Department of Health, when they come up with this list, HIV will be prominently factored there. We have an enormous issue in D.C. versus the rest of the country around that. Same thing with pain management, opioid abuse. So I believe those will be on there, hopefully. Vaccines, part of that. So I think it will probably be covered there. I'm just trying to eliminate the detailed requirements that are there, believing that those will probably be captured. I think there's value in pharmacists currently doing HIV and doing medication safety, just to keep these issues top of mind for people who may not work with those populations or work with those issues on a regular basis. But more and more, these detailed requirements. Concern it gets to be more of a burden, and we have to hope that the professional will exercise their own judgment about what their particular needs are.
And the LGBTQ doesn't change because that was a separate law.
That stays.
Right. Okay.
I wanted to say something. So if the board did want to make suggestions, definitely I would be willing to take those back. If you all have topics that you feel like, you know, definitely should be on there. But I can't. I can't make any guarantees from my perspective as far as that list. So if you want to wait till the list comes out, it definitely may capture those two requirements. But I do agree with Mr. Appleby not trying to nail down the CE requirement so far, because you want to make sure the practitioner is focusing on things that help them.
And Carl was just asking what our sort of wish list might be to help provide some guidance for drafting of possible regulations. And this isn't over. This is just a wish list, right? So it could be based on how new information that comes out, everything will have to change. But, so that motion was just sort of get us started down a wish list. And to the point of LGBTQ cultural sensitivity issues being a separate item, the HIV requirement, did that come down as a mandate that all boards would add that? Is there a separate law around that? Because I don't recall it being anything we had to think about. I seem to remember being told that boards would add that. Is that a separate law?
It was not a law. It was the director of the Department of Health at that time requested that all of the boards add that. Mm-hmm. And that's
so we
how
did it through regulation.
Kind of like how this is.
So
it was a request, though.
Yes.
This doesn't feel much like a request.
It was the same kind of request, same type of situation.
It is a request.
In the military, that's called being voluntold.
So. And that's how HIV was done.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
It was an initiative from the director at that time. This is an initiative from the director that we currently
have. If we were to approve this motion, we would go back and amend our current regulations around CE requirements to remove the HIV and the med safety. And just, I know this isn't part of the motion. I agree with the intent, and that way the district has the flexibility to kind of move the needle as the landscape changes. audits. Oh my gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, that's a potential nightmare. So, okay.
Yeah.
So there's some good discussion. Any more discussion? We have a motion that's been made and seconded. Is our general consist? So just to recap, the motion is So to recap, the motion is that when this does go into effect, it will be effective March 1st, 2023, during our next renewal cycle. And the requirement that we currently have for the 2 hours in HIV and the 2 hours in patient safety, we will remove that. So that is the current motion.
And it's not a mandate, it's just what the sense of the board is around this regulations at this point. If we have the ability to influence them, that's the direction we will want them to go. That's really a sense of board motion, right? You're not required to do this. If something comes down from the director that's different, then we'll have to adjust our motion.
Okay.
For example, the timing. If they say, well, no, it has to be done starting today, effective when we renew our licenses in 2021, all bets are off, right?
So, no, what I'm asking for is what you want in your reg, and then we will draft it that way. The regulations are done under the authority of the Department of Health, and if changes need to be made, which sometimes happen, then those changes will be made. But at least, and the change would probably be to when it became effective. I don't think if you say you want to remove HIV and MedAirs, I don't think that that would be changed by the department. And just to clarify, this would be starting with the way it's going to be drafted is to start with the renewal period ending 2023, which means that after you renew in 2021, you would need to start working on these initiatives,
okay,
as opposed to starting in March of 2023, which would be the renewal of 2025.
Yep.
Okay? So with what you've given us, Brandon and I will go back and make a rulemaking that reflects what you have asked for as your wish list. If certainly if we learn something in the interim, we'll let you know. But otherwise, we'll come back in August with a regulation for you to vote to approve to move forward, and then it'll go through the process.
All right. As long as we're...
I just wanted to ask for us to consider just making med safety mandatory regardless. I'm not really confident that that's going to be added to the list, and because we're, you know, pharmacists, 80% of them practice in a dispensing role, I would like for us to consider keeping that as a board requirement.
What other board members feel about that? I'm happy to amend my motion.
I'm fine with that. I mean, I can't imagine that there's a... can't think of a practice environment within the profession where med safety is an important component, whether you're dispensing, consultation, administration, whatever. I'm just thinking about what we're talking about, though, not being overly prescriptive about, like, so where do we draw the line? So HIV may not, even though it's a problem in the district, it doesn't necessarily affect everybody equally in terms of practice environment. Med safety probably does. Definitely does more so, but I mean, when you were out, the point we were talking about was being, you know, prescriptive about just in general, and versus letting the department decide what are the issues at hand. Because we're creating our wish list, Carla, as part of a motion, could we also, part of our wish list, that the Board of Pharmacy would like to be able to provide input as to what should be on that 5-year or 3-year list or whatever, so that kind of gives us a little bit more say in what should be there for our profession.
See, I'm not sure, Shauna, how that's going to be administrated.
Right.
All of the board members.
Right. So I know we will be given the opportunity. So if you want to provide subjects and give them to me, the sooner the better, because I'm not sure where this is in the process, I can definitely follow up and let them know.
I mean, the thing that gnaws at me is, you know, on the surface it sounds good, but for the profession to not be thinking about what continuing education their licensees should be undertaking, just there's a disconnect for me there. I'm trying to weigh trying to balance being overly prescriptive, but I feel like the profession should certainly have a strong voice in the continuing education to the license.
Right. And I think it would be helpful if we had like a finalized list, then I could say, okay, these are things that are on the list. So hopefully by August we would have a finalized list and we may be able to, you know, kind of ease.
So could I withdraw my motion and make a new motion then? Is he okay with you?
Sure. Can I just say this? Bear in mind, this is only 10%, and I think that's why it's written that way, so that the boards do still maintain the overall responsibility and ability to direct what continuing education you feel is appropriate for your licensees. This is saying we're not adding any new requirements as to having to go from 40 to 44, but mm-hmm. within whatever amount you currently require, please add 10%. To focus on these public health priorities. And the rest of it is whatever. And that's why I'm saying, what is your wish list? Do you want to keep HIV? Do you want to keep MedAirs? It's up to you. I think initially the discussion was that it would automatically replace them, and that's not necessarily the case. It's up to you.
Okay, so one other question then. Is there any concern around ACPE approval? Because we don't know what the topics are going to be. So right now, to your point, it's 40 hours, and you're right, it's still ACPE, so we know it's going to be in the pharmacy world. Could people pick and choose from topics that aren't necessarily pharmacy-related because they want to do something about, I don't know what, but there's no we're still going to stick with ACPE approval, right? We have the
yes.
right to do that,
yes.
right?
That does not change, though.
Correct.
Okay. Okay.
So my new motion, though, would be that the sense of the board is that as a result of this new guidance from the Department of Public Health, we would recommend that this new requirement take effect with licenses renewing February 28, 2023, meaning the CE would have to begin to be earned starting March 1, 2021, and that when this new requirement takes effect, that our separate HIV requirement would be eliminated, but the patient safety specific CE requirement would be maintained, and that the board, on some periodic basis, would recommend topics for possible inclusion on the mayor's list, the department director's list.
I have a comment. You left out detailers, so you want for their next renewal cycle as well.
For everybody, yeah.
Okay.
For technicians. I'm sorry, that was very wrong. That'd be my motion.
All right, that's a mouthful. So there's a motion that's been made. Is there a second?
I'll second.
Discussion.
It's a great idea. Thank you for suggesting that tomorrow. I think it's good to include that in separate provisions. Thank you.
I'm just concerned that we now 8 hours of the 40 hours are described ahead of time. It just it's a lot.
You mean six?
No, because we have
LGBT,
med errors, and then four from this list.
And it's quite likely that both those topics will be on the list that comes from Department. It is possible. I wouldn't be surprised if those issues aren't considered public health issues, right? Appropriate cultural sensitivity and issues around patient safety. But I agree with your point. I don't disagree at all.
So what I will say is to make the suggestion to the director or Department of Health that the list focus more on disease states as opposed to practice issues or, you know, overall practice things, so that it's not duplicative. I'm making the assumption that it's going to be more disease states like opioid or HIV, etc. So, but it's hard to just make it. It's hard to do this without a list. So we're just trying to do the best that we can right now. So
I'm comfortable. All right. So there's been some good discussion again. Any more discussion? Is there general consensus in favor of the new motion? All right. All in favor say aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Abstentions? Motion carries. Thank you for that. and thank you for accommodating my scheduling conflict. I left another meeting rushed over here, so thank you for doing a great job of presiding, Mr. Appleby. So we, if we're ready, we will move on to the next item on our agenda, and it looks like, are we on 06?
Yes.
Communication Subcommittee Report. Perfect timing. So I guess the most pertinent update is, thanks to Dr. White, we were able to have a DC Pharmacy newsletter. The content was submitted to NABP. I'm thinking the newsletter might be published by now.
No, it's still not out.
Should it be out June or what?
Hopefully in the next week or so. Okay. They sent me the draft yesterday, so I have to review that.
Perfect. So for all of you who are interested, just remember you can go to NABP's website, go to state newsletters, and you'll be able to see all of the DC newsletters. So when this one, the latest one, is available, that's where you can find it. Other than that, I think towards the end we'll kind of just mention the annual meeting. But for now, I think I'll yield to our wonderful intern so that we can have our presentation. So if you could please introduce yourself.
Hello, my name is Hugh Hong. I'm the fourth year Doctor of Pharmacy candidate at Howard University College of Pharmacy. And today I will be presenting on pharmacy news. Four articles I'll be presenting on: the first generic naloxone spray approved by the FDA, the FDA strengthening warning requirements for insomnia drugs, new steps announced by the FDA related to the regulation of cannabis and cannabis-derived products, and California possibly making HIV PrEP medication available without prescription. So for my first article, the FDA gave its final approval on April 19, 2019 to TLL Pharmaceuticals USA to market the first generic naloxone nasal spray. This is an effort to make this emergency overdose reversal treatment more available and to reduce death due to overdose. The FDA has also stated that it will continue to support the development of over-the-counter and generic versions of naloxone, and it will also try to increase access to this treatment by granting priority review to all abbreviated new drug applications for products indicated for the emergency treatment of opioid overdose, and to reduce drug price by the promotion of drug competition with the Drug Competition Action Plan. The FDA stated that its current priorities on this matter are to decrease exposure and prevent new addiction, fostering development of novel pain therapies, supporting the treatment of patients with opioid use disorder, and improving enforcement and assessing benefit risk. And this is just a little picture about what you might see soon. Next article. There have been reports of rare but serious side effects that have occurred in patients while taking certain insomnia medications, more common in isoketone, xylophone, and zolpidem. And these side effects have resulted in serious injury or death. So the FDA has required box warnings to be on prescribing information and medication guides. These box warnings inform the patient and prescriber that patients while on this medication may experience complex sleep behaviors such as sleepwalking and sleep driving, which may put them at risk for serious injury and death. The FDA has also added a contraindication to avoid these medications on patients who have previously experienced those behaviors while on the three medications. The new steps announced by the FDA related to regulation of cannabis and cannabis-derived products. So the FDA recently had a public hearing held on May 31st to obtain input from stakeholders and address questions and concerns. Attendees were from various backgrounds, such as consumers, academia, agriculture, and healthcare professionals. The FDA has also created a high-level internal agency to explore potential pathways for dietary supplements and conventional foods containing CBD to be offered in the market. To further address the questions and concerns, the FDA has updated its FAQ page concerning the regulation of cannabis. The FDA has also issued warning letters in collaboration with the Federal Trade Commission to companies that have unfounded claims on the products. Some companies are Advanced Fine and Pain, NutriPure, and Hotnet for Holdings. Some of the claims were that their products could treat, manage, or cure certain disease states such as cancer, osteoporosis, or dementia. My next article is California possibly making HIV PrEP medication available without a prescription. So State Senator Scott Wiener proposed Bill SB-159 to make Truvada HIV pre-exposure prophylaxis available without prescription. But this is not without condition, however, because patients would still need to see a physician for subsequent prescriptions. And and the pharmacist still needs to test the patient for HIV and perform a kidney function test on the patient to confirm patient eligibility. But there is opposition to this bill from State Senator Brian Jones and the California Medical Association. And this opposition creates controversy because on one side, there's increasing access to patients who may not be able to receive this treatment in a timely manner or an efficient manner. And on the other side, the opposition argues that patient safety is at risk because these medications may increase the risk for kidney injury and that they should only be prescribed under the direct care of a physician. And I think that's all I have today. These are the references. And do you have questions?
Thank you.
Sure.
You have a couple of questions. So,
Hi, Hugh. Thank you for the presentation. What are your thoughts about the PrEP regulation?
I think it might be a good thing because it's increasing patient access and decreasing infection rates. And there's a lot of law around it, so like it includes patient safety where they still need to have a HIV test, a kidney function test, and if they still want to continue on this medication, they're going to have to see a doctor sooner or later. And they'll be counseled by the pharmacist beforehand. So I think I guess a little bit more for the bill.
And Mr. Freeman?
Yes, so just along those lines, great presentation, by the way. How do you envision that playing out? So you mentioned that pharmacists would be doing the HIV test.
Mm-hmm.
So they would be ordering the test, or would they be performing, doing the draw, blood draw?
The bill did not explicitly say what they would be doing in that role, but I think they could perform the HIV test with the swab. As far as the kidney function test, they could have done that. explicitly say what they were doing.
Can patients do a self HIV test now?
I'm not sure.
Does anybody know?
Say it again.
I think you can
order a test.
For HIV?
Yeah,
you get it online, yep, it's over the counter, yep.
Okay, I thought so. And I was just thinking about the whole piece of a pharmacist's role, depending on what the results are of the test and how to handle that versus having that doctor-patient interaction. And then again, whether they're just ordering the test, like we do through collaborative practice, or whether they're actually administering the test. So very interesting. And then the whole piece around Truvada, the significance of the drug on, body functions and potential contraindications with other meds, etc.
Interesting. Very interesting. Let me see where that goes. Any other questions? No questions? Wonderful presentation. Right along to the next item, I think the NABP newsletter, you guys kind of have a list of the things. There are only a couple of things that I will just briefly mention for the sake of time. There was a very successful DEA drug take back day that was held recently, and I forgot the date. It is on the board. But whatever we can do, I always like to remind the public, whatever we can do to encourage family, our neighbors, our friends, our students, our customers to take full advantage of drug take-back days. We absolutely want to do that. Remember, that's one less medication that's out there for someone to unfortunately abuse. In addition to that, I think we have some pharmacists in the audience, and I think it's really important to note recalls. And so for those of you who weren't aware, there was a recall of Ketorolac. Due to some impurities, the sterility assurance just was not there. So just be on the lookout for that if you have not been aware of that, especially if you're out there and you're dispensing and interrupting the patients. And then the last item that I just wanted to kind of mention is the 115th annual NABP meeting that was just recently held in Minneapolis. And the D.C. Board of Pharmacy was consumer member, Ms. Takeda Sanders, were there. Thought it was a pretty meaningful meeting in terms of interacting with colleagues. We have some new members of our executive board, new president-elect, a new representative for District 2, which some of us are familiar with as KJAL. And so it was a well-attended meeting. I want to give Sean an opportunity to give any. Did you want to say anything about the meeting?
No, I just wanted to talk about some of the presentations at the meeting. I'm not sure if you wanted to comment on, but a lot of them surrounded types of technology and pharmacy and advancement of patient care using technology. So there was a lot of, I guess I don't want to say use the word telemedicine, but a lot of talk about telemedicine and getting access to care for patients and thinking about patients and how convenient technology is allowing them to work through the healthcare system. So that was very, very informative.
And I also think the one on patient-centered care, in terms of patient-centered practice standards being the focus more so than, I guess, from the regulatory side, that was a presentation on that, and it seemed like there was a lot of interest around that. I can see how that could get a bit complicated.
excuse me.
But it was a good meeting. The main thing is we always want to make sure that DC is represented at these events. We handle business during the business sessions, and so I'm happy that we were able to
So one thing that we should think about is, because I think boards in general have a challenging time keeping up with technology, the regulatory process, it moves faster than the boards do sometimes, and maybe it's an opportunity for us to kind of look at our telepharmacy. I think we've got some regulations, but they're very old, and maybe we could revisit and update and bring them up to the current practice needs for the profession and sort of align with telemedicine so that we're serving the consumers the way that they can and should be served to make access easier.
Yeah, and I know that's certainly a topic. It's certainly something that the board has looked at and it's on our radar. But yeah, point well taken, because we want to make sure this is a lot. One of the presentations was on like artificial intelligence and the role that may play in terms of the pharmacy realm. And so to your point, if this is the direction that that we're rapidly moving, we want to make sure that we're well positioned so that we can make, you know, adjustments as necessary. Next year's meeting, everyone in the room is going to be very excited because guess where it's going to be? In Baltimore.
Oh,
right down the street. So we're very excited about that. I want to challenge the board to continue to do something that the D.C. Board of Pharmacy has done for years, and I really want to acknowledge Dr. White and her leadership as the executive director. Working with students and training students and involving students with the regulatory side of it has always been something that this board has been committed to doing. I want to applaud you for that. Typically, we have students presenting because there's a poster session at the annual meeting. This year, we did not, but next year, I am certain that we will have at least one student. North Dakota is not going to keep running the show and have three or four posters. I'm hoping Howard University or in other schools that the students work with the DC Board of Pharmacy with, they will be able to have a presentation to kind of really show the collaboration is happening. We just want to make sure that, you know, we're able to kind of demonstrate that. So with it being right in Baltimore, then I think that puts us in a better position. So we're really excited about that. Just a reminder, the District 1 and 2 regional meeting will be in Vermont. People are excited about the Ben and Jerry's tour. And then there's a big golf excursion that's going to be taking place. The speakers have been identified. The CE topics have been identified. I want to say the plan is for all that to be uploaded on the website. I thought Anita said by around June 15th. But when you're if you are interested, then you'll be able to go to the District 1, NABP District 1 website, and you'll see the meeting information. And TJAL is also going to include it on the District 2 website as well. So we're excited about that that taking place.
And if you're interested in attending that meeting, if you could let me know. And that is September the 19th and through September the 21st.
Dr. Bernard, are you continuing in the position as the chair?
So until things are, I guess, officially transitioned, then my understanding is yes. And then what I communicated to Caroline and the other members that were on our call last Friday is Shauna will be the appropriate point of contact with the our executive committee liaison, who's Mel Tejal, to kind of update them on where things are. Until I know otherwise, then I'm happy to continue to serve in that role, and then the transition part will leave the other people involved at the real decision makers. But that's it's a valid point, because remember, these meetings aren't just a time for us to come together and do continuing education and all that. We have business that we must handle as a regulatory body, and so business will take place at the regional meeting as well. Any questions or anything? All right. Hearing none, we will move to the next item on the agenda, and that's item 08, military spousal licensure for pharmacists. And so if you will recall that at our last meeting, this actually came up. We're bringing it back to the board so that we can take a formal vote. In essence, a concern was expressed by a military spouse. And he not only contacted the D.C. board, he's contacted probably all of the boards in the country, but a good number of the boards, about the challenges that a military spouse faces when they are reassigned, and they have to, as we know, take the MPJE and get licensed in this new state so that they can practice. And so when I looked at this for a fourth time, I asked myself, what is the ask? What is this gentleman who has a valid concern, what is he asking of all these boards of pharmacy to do? And I read it again, and it looks like, and Carla will clarify this, but it looks like his ask is for the boards around the country, including D.C., to kind of start a conversation and try, and maybe start to work with, the government agencies so that they can see if maybe there's a chance that there could be another approach to this. Clear that up, please.
Yeah, what I was going to say is that the city council is already looking at legislation to address exactly what he's asking for, so I'm assuming he reached out to them as well. So this is already under consideration by the council. I'm not sure where they are in the process, but they're looking at this for all of the health professionals in D.C.
So since it's on our agenda, and since I don't want to take up too much time, but I want to make sure that our time is well spent, are these two potential asks? One, that a person who, for a military spouse, will treat them as if a license in one state is applicable to all states, similar to how if you work in a government facility, then as long as you have one license, you don't have to get individually licensed. So that's one thing, I guess, that may come out of this. The second thing that I was wondering if maybe a possibility is the ask that, there'll be a 6-month window whereby a person can come into a state and practice pharmacy for 6 months without a license, so that'll give them more time. I don't know if anybody has had any more thoughts around what this request might result in. Any thoughts, or is this?
My sense is that this is really a matter for legislative bodies versus regulatory. I'm glad to hear that it sounds like DC Council's considering this issue, especially given the density of military Department of Defense bases in the DC area. I think it's very appropriate for them to be considering it. So hopefully they will be able to strike the right balance to ensure people have some flexibility, but that we're protecting the public health sometimes.
Absolutely. And so I'm going to ask for guidance from council, because this was brought back before the board for an official vote. And so can you give us some kind of, at least that's what it says here.
But I don't know that we need to vote. I think when this was put on the agenda, staff may not have been aware that this is already in front of the council.
Gotcha.
I don't know that you want to vote to not consider it.
but I don't think that you need to consider it. It's already, he's asking you to basically advocate to the council to do something the council's already doing. So I see it as moot, and perhaps it can just be, if I'm assuming he's aware of it, but maybe it can be communicated back to him that the council's already considering this, and then close it out with that, that information.
So there'll be a letter that will go to the gentleman to let him know that this was discussed and these are, this is what these are.
And okay. You can actually direct him. I'll see. I'm not sure if the council's actually formally introduced something. If they have, then I can give you that information for him. If they haven't, then we can find out what committee's looking at it and direct him to that committee.
Okay. That's a great idea. Okay. Any comments or any more discussion on that? No? All right. So we'll move on to the next item, 009. So this is a request from Howard University for exemption for international students that participate in a shadowing opportunity. And you know, I think it's probably a good idea for me to recuse myself.
Yeah, we both have to.
Okay. All right. So I'm Daphne Bernard, for the record. I'm going to recuse myself from the discussion on item 009. And
Amara McCann.
So.
Board members, agenda item 9. In the open session, you'll find in your materials a letter directed to Dr. White regarding her question from Howard University to grant an exemption to some of the requirements as it relates to having visiting students participate in some activities. Sean, is there anything else you want to sort of say, sort of tee up this dialogue?
Right. So this conversation stems from the point of the visiting students, and should the visiting students be considered as interns, or like what would their practice be? Typically, when students come from another university, if they're in pharmacy school and they come to a practice site, they're considered as interns and they're required to register with the Board of Pharmacy. And I guess if the board would, based on this letter, consider a policy for students that are enrolled in pharmacy schools in other countries and they're coming to the District of Columbia to work with Howard University or trying to seek experiences in facilities involved with the university's program, what would the board, what's the policy, or what would the board consider as far as, are they shadowing, are they acting as an intern, just to get feedback so we can respond to the letter.
So I have had international students before, and generally, they're, you know, not familiar with the names of the drugs that we have, and they're not really hands-on doing that much. It's mostly a shadowing experience, and I don't see why they would really need any kind of registration with the board, especially if it's a relatively short-term type of thing.
It seems... I'm just looking at the request, so it seems like the request is to give them an exemption from the intern requirements, but I agree with Dr. Miles. The question is, are they considered an intern? If they're considered an intern, that's a different conversation about, are you going to exempt them versus anybody else? An intern is an intern, and the intern is supposed to have certain obligations, accountabilities, the responsibilities, or things they can and cannot do. The question for me is, you know, if they're not to be considered an intern, do we have any oversight? I mean, somebody come into the pharmacy and just observe, and while people are around and you talk to them, they're not filling, they're not dispensing, they're not using clinical judgment, they're not contacting patients, they're not ringing up a register, they're not doing pharmacist or technician or intern duties, really, because those are in the regs, what the intern duties can do. They're just observing. I don't know that there's anything to waive if they're not an intern, if the ask is to waive the intern requirement.
requirement for them. That's a different conversation. I would maybe have a little bit more pause for pause about that, quite frankly.
Do I understand, Shauna, that these are all international students?
Yeah.
Right. True. So they will be here.
And do I understand that none of them are actually enrolling at Howard University School of Pharmacy? They're merely visiting for some modest amount of time.
Right. So they'll be a pharmacy student, say, in their home country, uh-huh. and they're coming to Howard University to participate in either like an exchange program or a program where a student would come and see what how pharmacists or pharmacy is practiced here.
Which their institution where they're a student though be thinking that they're getting Would their institution be thinking, though, that the student is doing rotations here where they're getting intern or extern hours? Because we don't want to give that false...
I think that's a different story. Okay. I think that what this is referring to is students who come over for a short period of time. They're not completing a 4 or 5 week rotation. Right. It's just an observational sort of thing. And it seems to me, that to piggyback on what you said before, that they're not really performing intern duties, so they would just be exempt from our regulations anyway.
But I did want to follow up on that point. In her letter, it says the students are moving from site to site after 1 or 2 weeks. So, to me, if they're moving from site to site, it's more like a rotation where you move from site to site versus just, I'm just going to come here for 1 or 2 weeks, kind of observe, and then I'm done. But to me, when they say site to site, it's a continuous process.
So in the experiences that I've had, I've done this through VCU, and they come to me for 3-ish days, and then maybe they do a couple of days at the FDA, maybe they do a couple of days at another hospital or a retail pharmacy, and the idea is for them to get, just to see how we practice pharmacy in this country, and they're not actually doing anything. They just shadow.
The letter from Howard indicates that these individuals, they have a travel and a tourist visa, and they're required to have background checks, HIPAA training and certification, infection control training and certification, and obtain Howard identification. So I think one question that comes to mind is that the overarching philosophy of this board has been that we don't want anyone in the pharmacy who we don't know is there, or know why they're there and what their role is, hence technician regulation as well as intern regulation. Is there any concern anyone has that these individuals, while it appears that they will be wearing Howard University identification and they've gone through background checks and HIPAA training, which is important. Any concern about that or not? It sounds like from a practical matter, your experience is that it's not an issue. They're just here to observe. They're not doing anything, and the letter indicates they would not be doing that, and not be doing any of these issues. So they're tasks.
So I have some concerns because it does seem, on the one hand, that they're going through sort of a formal enrollment period, if you will, to participate in the program. And the letter says that they will not be doing the above criteria and for more than 70% of the time. Doesn't talk about the rest, the other 30%. It's a little dicey about what they may be doing and would they be doing any activities that are part of intern activities, and then they would potentially fall under. I mean, why would we want to create a waiver? Does it somehow impact patient safety? So I think it's highly unusual. And then would there be any other type of practice environment where we would be looking at intern responsibilities? And I don't think that's where they're going with this, but I'm not really sure that we're landing in a solid place there.
I think by the 70%, they're just referring to our regulation that says that the intern will spend more than 70% of their time.
Right, but if they're... I mean, the question for me is, are they an intern or not? Because if they're not...
not an intern, there's nothing to provide a waiver for.
Yeah, I had never looked at them as an intern. It was
right.
Like they were just sort of the shadows.
If they're not an intern, the question's sort of moot.
Yeah.
I guess another question would be, are they receiving credit for this experience?
Right. That's what I was asking before. Like, is their institution thinking that they're getting credit?
Wouldn't they have to be here on some sort of education business or something like that?
Here's my other concern, Ms. Appleby. It seems to me by the nature of the request that Howard is looking at them as an intern because they're asking for an exemption from the intern requirement.
So would a response be that based upon the information provided, responsibilities being carried out by these visiting students are not consistent with intern-related experiences, therefore we're not able to grant an exception because it's not relevant in this case, but then also to remind them that whatever any activities they undertake with the licensed personnel overseeing them will be held responsible for all of whatever activities they do undertake. We're going to talk about rounding with physicians and debriefing cases with the pharmacists and all that. Someone has to be responsible for what they do, right? A licensed professional. Yep, Carla.
Yeah. Unless I'm missing something, it's just this one page letter, right? It assumes a lot, and it's following up with a conversation with Dr. White. So for me, it doesn't really say exactly what they want. They review the regulations. Students will not be doing this. They will be doing this. What exactly are they asking for? I guess it's the question. I think it probably needs to be flushed out more, and maybe then it would be easier for the board to make a decision if you are very clear on who they are, what they're going to be doing, and all the things you're saying, why. Because it's saying about 70% of the time. What about the other 30% of the time? So for me, I think it's almost like the discussion we had earlier about the training program. I just don't know that you have the answers to all of your questions. And I think for the board to say it's okay, and then we find out that they're doing something that we didn't know, because this is it's pretty limited. So I think if it can more formally really say who they are, what they're going to be doing, where they're going to be doing it, how we will know who's in there, how the other people in the pharmacy will know, whether someone from the school be there with them, will the people in the pharmacy, exactly, are they getting credit, will the people in the pharmacy know that they shouldn't be touching or handling anything, they should only be watching, do what they're watching. I think there's a lot of questions. Perhaps someone from Howard can come and explain it and then answer questions.
I agree.
Okay, therefore,
so do we need a formal motion, or is it just a...
I think a motion that, do you want them to come in, or just provide greater detail?
It might be helpful if they come in, so that way we have additional follow-up questions, so they can answer them, and we're not, you know...
Well, back and forth, I agree.
How about then a motion to ask that this person who's wrote the letter, or if they said
it, the dean, or just her representative,
or your representative come to the board meeting and discuss this.
So moved.
Second.
All right, there's a motion to invite the dean and professor to offer this letter to come and meet with us, or the representative. That's seconded, and any further discussion? It's a general consensus in favor of the motion. There is, therefore, I'll ask all those in favor to vote by saying aye.
Aye.
Opposed, say no. Abstentions? Motion carries. Yep. We're coming up on the opportunity for public comments. So thank you all for your flexibility that we are running a little bit behind our normal plan, but there is opportunity for public comments.
right, thank you. Daphne Bernard back at the table, as well as Tamara McCant. I think we open it up for questions. I want to make sure there are no questions from the public. All right, hearing none, it looks like we are ready to adjourn. Is that right?
Madam Chair, I move that the board close the open public session portion of the meeting, move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code S2-575B for the following purposes: to discuss disciplinary matters pursuant to Section 2-575B9, seek the advice of counsel to the board to preserve attorney-client privilege, or to approve settlement agreements pursuant to Section 2-575B4, and to plan, discuss, or hear reports concerning ongoing or planned investigations pursuant to Section 2-575B14.
Okay, thank you for that motion. Is there a second?
Second.
Okay, and so we'll take a roll call vote. We'll begin with Mr. Appleby.
I vote in favor of the motion.
Okay.
I vote in favor of the motion.
Okay.
I vote in favor of the motion. Benjamin Miles in favor of the motion.
So the motion carries. This concludes the public open session of the meeting. The board will now move into the closed executive session portion of the meeting pursuant to DC Official Code 2-575B for the reasons set forth in the motion. So we adjourn at 12 p.m. and we want to thank you all for coming, and we will see you August the 1st, same time, same place. Thank you.
Well, I've been cutting it out.
Oh my God, really?
Check it out. Lunch, you know. Google that right now.
Flavored cottage.